This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Afghan President Hamid Karzai refuses to sign a bilateral security agreement with the U.S., so President Barack Obama has issued an ultimatum. Without that agreement, the U.S. is going to pull out all of its troops from Afghanistan by the end of the year, and NATO has vowed to follow suit. The military and diplomatic situation in Afghanistan has grown increasingly complex since the U.S. invaded in 2001, and that's something that Carl Eikenberry knows a lot about. A man who calls his home Goldsboro, North Carolina, served two tours of duty in Afghanistan with the U.S. Army before being named ambassador to that country in 2009. As ambassador, he made headlines when his concerns about the effects of an American military buildup became public. Carl Eikenberry has since retired and is now doing scholarly research at Stanford. He's back here in North Carolina to take part in a panel discussion at NC State later today, but is with us right now on the State of Things. Carl Eikenberry, welcome. Good to have you here.
Frank, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with the headlines. You know, we spent blood and treasure in Afghanistan to secure, hopefully, for national security reasons in the U.S. Hamid Karzai now says he will not sign a bilateral security agreement with the U.S. What do you make of that and President Obama's decision to simply pull out if he doesn't?
Well, first, Frank, what is a bilateral security agreement and why is it important? But the bilateral security agreement that's much in the news right now is a formal agreement between the United States and Afghanistan that awaits signature by President Karzai that would give then legal sovereignty to the United States of America for any actions committed by our soldiers, say, or airmen or Marines in the ground in Afghanistan that could be an infraction of Afghan law. Of course, this is important. Say that we have an American soldier driving in the back roads of Afghanistan and tragically strikes a Afghan villager and kills that Afghan citizen. Sovereign immunity then applies, and the United States has the first choice of dealing with this legally. We have these kind of agreements with all of the countries in which we have U.S. armed forces stationed, Japan, Korea, Germany. In the case of Afghanistan, of course, even more essential we have such an agreement because Afghanistan is a country that's still struggling to constitute a government, and its legal system is, we can say, somewhat immature at this point. So no U.S. president serving as commander-in-chief, of course, is going to put U.S. forces in a country unless that agreement exists. Now, why is it important then that we have U.S. forces in Afghanistan after 2014? And that is for two reasons. One is that we still have a threat from terrorism in the region, greatly diminished, but still exist. And our forces in Afghanistan and our intelligence elements benefit from operations in Afghanistan. You recall when we struck against bin Laden, those forces actually launched out of Afghanistan. Secondly, although our forces are no longer directly participating in combat operations against the Taliban, the forces that could stay on after 2014 are, I think, vital for helping to continue to train and equip the Afghan National Security Forces, the Army and Police. So the agreement is important. And if we don't have a signed agreement by the end of this year, then U.S. forces will come home, and that will have very serious consequences for the stability of Afghanistan and, I think, to an extent, for our ability to continue to wage war against al-Qaeda.
So that's why it's important to us. If you're Hamid Karzai in what is even a nominal democracy, you can understand the political pressures, given the number of civilian casualties that resulted from the U.S. invasions, many of them accidental. You can understand that a president of a democracy like that would have a lot of pressure not to give carte blanche to a military force that has caused a fair amount of damage.
Yeah, interesting, Frank. President Karzai is not eligible for re-election according to the Constitution of the state, 2 5-year terms, and that's it. And so he finishes that second of 5-year terms here shortly, and there is a presidential campaign underway in Afghanistan in which there's now 10 candidates running for president. Frank, all 10 of those candidates have said, if elected, they'll sign the agreement. So there's a element of frustration with the Afghan people in terms of the long presence of international military forces, but still extending down to most of the Afghans, even at the village level. They know the importance that the U.S. and the NATO forces provide for them in terms of enhancing their security. Now, there's a lot of reasons that President Karzai is adopted a position that he's not going to sign the agreement. We can talk about those if you'd like.
Well, I'd like to talk about your experience with President Karzai and the institutions in Afghanistan when you were ambassador there. Let's start there, because you also served two tours as a general, including commander of the forces there. Army. But from 2009 to 2011, you were an ambassador. What was your experience with Hamid Karzai and in trying to deal with the level of development in their institutions?
Yeah, I think that all of our ambassadors that have served in Afghanistan have found it diplomatically challenging, and that's it's understandable. I'd give you three explanations of President Karzai's policies and attitudes towards the United States. First of all, President Karzai became the president of a country that had been through several decades of warfare and trauma. And so his challenges of trying to reconstitute a state were very, very significant, in spite of the levels of help that were being provided to him. Still a very significant challenge. President Karzai, he has a lot of political skills. One of his strong suits is not the ability to build the state. So he's not necessarily an Ataturk or a George Washington, understanding the importance of institutions. And I think he would admit that as well. So there's a degree of frustration on his part there, wanting to do a good job for his people, but still problems with just the technical competence. Secondly, I think that President Karzai, over time, became very frustrated with the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. This, I mean, when we went in right after the 9/11 and quickly toppled the Taliban and pushed al-Qaeda out of the country, we had enormous success, but we didn't destroy them. They reconstituted inside of Pakistan, and over time, then, with a decision understandable on our government's part, whether it was President Bush's administration, President Obama's administration, that they weren't going to carry the war into Pakistan, then a second best strategy was to base operations out of Afghanistan to deal with the problems in Pakistan. As a result of that, over time, then the insurgency grows in Afghanistan. We're fighting the foot soldiers of the Taliban. The generals are on the other side of the border. And there's frustration with President Karzai and many Afghans that although we came in as liberators, we weren't able to close the deal, so to speak. And then a third factor with President Karzai is, of course, that any politician wants to maximize power, and they want to continue to find ways to enjoy the office of the presidency and the riches that go with this. And there's been a unwillingness of President Karzai to take tough steps to deal with corruption, to deal with problems of weak institutions, and very frankly, then those who are supportive of him, to include family members, have greatly benefited from that unwillingness to deal with serious problems.
We put a great deal of confidence in Hamid Karzai in the run-up to our invasion, and certainly in the immediate aftermath. How much did we know about him? And let me expand that question, because you talked about what we encountered after we took Kabul. That we found our enemy had crossed the border, it found safe harbor in Pakistan, and that was a much more difficult war to fight. How much of that should we have known? Didn't we know? Didn't we anticipate that that would be the aftermath of Kabul? And didn't we know who Hamid Karzai was before we went into that war?
Frank, we didn't know a lot. Certainly, as I was a brigadier general on the Army staff working in the Pentagon when American Airlines Flight 77, commandeered by, hijacked by al-Qaeda, crashed into the Pentagon. At that point in time, Afghanistan was brought to the United States of America, but none of us knew a great deal about it. We have to remember, though, that after 9/11, there was an imperative, and that was to counterattack against al-Qaeda. We did not know how capable al-Qaeda was, and there was a moral and a political imperative and a security imperative that we strike quickly. And so in the case of Afghanistan, we did strike quickly. We did not have at that point in time a lot of understanding of the politics of Afghanistan. But the military imperative was strike fast. I think what happened, though, is then after we then intervened in Afghanistan, we had a United Nations mandate. We assumed that we had time on our side. The international community did. The Afghans thought time was on their side. It would be difficult to help to rebuild the state of Afghanistan, but it could eventually take place. And what we had not anticipated then, as I had said earlier, that Taliban had managed to cross the border into Pakistan. They gained sanctuary. We could not go into Pakistan. So then over a period of time from 2002 to 2006 and 7, slowly we start to take on more and more state-building tasks because our forces are there. There's an assumption that as long as our forces are there, we need to help the state of Afghanistan to reconstitute a government, develop its economy. And suddenly, we find ourselves in 2007 to 2008 that we've got a massive commitment in that country, but we've never stopped and established a clear set of political objectives for what are we trying to accomplish with this force presence.
We'll talk about the consequences of that, the expansion of that mission, and perhaps the lack of preparation for that when my conversation with Carl Eikenberry continues, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He joins NC State Chancellor Randy Woodson and Humanities Dean Jeff Braden this afternoon. They're going to talk about the importance of the humanities and social sciences when it comes to forming public policy. That happens later today. Our conversation in just a moment on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Carl Eikenberry is with me, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, grew up in Goldsboro. While you were ambassador, you made headlines. Some cables that you had were secret, sent back to the White House, were made public. And you expressed concern about a military buildup that you thought would be counterproductive. And precisely for some of the reasons we were talking about, that that in many ways the United States was taking on responsibilities that you and others felt should be the responsibility of the Afghan people, and that we were slowing the progress in that. Tell us more about, because it did become certainly a point of contention and a real challenge to U.S. policy at that moment.
Yeah. Frank, in terms of leaking of cables, leaking of classified information, let me be clear that this is terribly damaging to United States diplomacy and to United States security. So whoever did leak those cables, I hope one day they're brought to justice, because if we lose the ability in the United States government to provide our best assessments in confidence without the fear that they're going to be publicly leaked, which is damaging politically to us domestically, and it's damaged in terms of our ability to conduct diplomacy, not good news. Having said that, the concerns that I had as ambassador, and I think these were concerns shared by many, that if we were to surge more troops into Afghanistan with the military situation, the security situation at that time unquestionably not being good. Taliban did have momentum on the battlefield, so to speak. But the idea of surging troops forward without very clear conditions for when would those troops then reach their limit of advance, so to speak, and when could they start coming home? That's what was worrisome. That one, the possibility of the Afghans developing more dependency on the United States, and a real artificial dependency, a dependency that was based upon levels of development assistance and military assistance that certainly would not be sustained. So how would we reach a point where we could define the conditions under which we could start to disengage? Secondly, there is opportunity cost that go with large-scale commitments to places like Afghanistan or Iraq. So we, of course, talk about what's the cost of development assistance, what's the cost of military assistance, what's the cost in terms of human lives and casualties. There's another cost as well, and that's strategic opportunity cost. So as the President and Congress are focused heavily on Iraq or Afghanistan, as of course they have to be when you have 100,000, 150,000 troops fighting there, then the concern is, are is equal attention being given to places like East Asia and China? Is equal attention being given to Latin America and to South Asia? So these were the various concerns that I did have. Now, the president, when he announced the surge at West Point in a speech in December of 2009, he also stipulated that those surge forces would start to come home in the summer of 2011, and he did so. With that decision, then, to begin to have a date set for the surge forces to start to come home, at that point, I believe that we did have the conditions that were now been made explicit for disengagement, eventually, of the U.S. military forces from Afghanistan.
Of course, setting a date is not the same as setting an objective or a goal, right? How do we know we won?
That is correct. Setting a date is important, though, because it sends a signal to the American military that here's the limit of your surge force and your military operations. And it was also very important to provide conditions understood by the Afghans about how much aid would we provide for how long. You know, a military commander, of course, if given a mission to stabilize Afghanistan, he wants maximum flexibility. He wants to say that I need so many troops, and I will tell you, Mr. President, when the conditions have been reached that we have stability. But what the military also needs to understand at senior levels of command is that their military advice has to be politically informed, that a president also has conditions, both as the president and commander-in-chief. And those conditions can be, one, economic, that our economy is in trouble, generals, and that I only have so many resources we can commit. And it can also be a political condition that I can't sustain the war politically or among our allies beyond a certain point in time. But I think the president did thread the needle well, so to speak, when he set a date certain for the end of the surge. And then very quickly thereafter, which was his intent, sit down with the Afghan leadership and begin to negotiate a transition process, which will lead to them then to achieve full responsibility for their sovereignty.
You're at Stanford now. You've had a long time some time to think about this and write about it. What are some of the lessons we've learned from Afghanistan?
Well, I think, Frank, we've spoken about those. First of all, the need before we go into a major intervention that we have a serious discussion about the political conditions that will lead to us to conclude success has been achieved, rather than a knee-jerk reaction that there's a problem in the world, let's send the cavalry in to deal with it. You need a very deliberate political discussion informed with best military advice about what are the objectives that you are trying to achieve. You know, in the case of Afghanistan, for instance, that, as I had said, we seemed after our intervention to just walk forward but not be very clear as to where the exit ramp might be. And in the case of Afghanistan, what I saw as the United States ambassador, at times, Frank, it was as if we were fighting three different wars. We had the United States embassy war, which was a struggle to help the Afghan government to develop an accountable, democratic, representative form of government and help them economically. We had a military war to fight the Taliban, defeat them, and train and equip a capable Afghan army and police. And third, we had the CIA war to go after bin Laden and hunt him down with the rest of al-Qaeda and destroy them, to dismantle that organization. And within those three different wars, then, the complexity of trying to find the relationships between them, to prioritize resources and prioritize diplomatic objectives, quite challenging.
Well, and it strikes me that you end up with those three wars and all of that complexity because you didn't have those objectives clearly defined and clearly articulated to the American public and to the military before you went in. And again, this, you can be angry after 2001, but that doesn't mean you can't plan. I wonder if I can make a comparison right here, because often we go back to World War II as the Great War, the one time when we were all together. But I can think of two other times of military engagement, two other examples. George H.W. Bush leading a coalition coalition into the Middle East, ejecting Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, a successful war, and in many ways, one that was deemed justified. And again, Bill Clinton leading a coalition to eject the Serbians from Kosovo, a limited engagement with clearly defined objectives and two clear wins, I think, as history looks back on those. How would you compare those encounters with what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think that, Frank, as you had said, clearly defined political objectives. President H.W. Bush, at the critical moment about whether to continue the march during Desert Storm, the first Iraq war in 1991, where he makes that critical decision to hold the force back and not march on to Baghdad. And we saw what the march to Baghdad can lead to and the restraint that he showed, understanding well second and third order consequences, understanding the impact on the alliance. I think that he'll get very and has gotten good marks from historians from that. And the same with President Clinton in Kosovo, that he tried to work hard to build the coalition to try to bring the United Nations into it. But having done so, set very limited objectives for his military application of force. In the case of Afghanistan and Iraq, it's the absence of those political objectives that I think led to so many years of tragedy.
I want to take us to another region of the world. I know you've thought and written about this as well, the rapid rise of China and the Asian Pacific. And again, opportunity cost. Are we paying enough attention? Tell us more about that.
Well, we've had an extraordinarily successful Asia-Pacific policy, a security policy, since the end of the Second World War, which has enjoyed great bipartisan support, maybe with the exception of the Vietnam War era. But if you look at the state of the Asia-Pacific in terms of socioeconomic and political development in 1945 and contrast it with how it is in 2014, it's miraculous, the rise of Asia. Half the world's GDP is now centered in the Asia-Pacific region, half the world's population. You have many strong, vibrant democracies in that region of the world, and it's critically important to the U.S. economy. Much of our trade is migrating to the Asia-Pacific area. Much of our investment and much of the foreign direct investment in our country is coming from Asia-Pacific. So that seven decades of prosperity and success has been underpinned by the U.S. security commitments to many of our Asia-Pacific partners and by our presence. We're starting to see signs of stress to that architecture. Part of that stress is coming from the extraordinary, really rapid rise of China. Economic powerhouse and its military is starting to become more capable. So important that the United States focus on the Asia-Pacific region. President Obama, in late 2011-2012, formally announced a new policy with regard to the Asia-Pacific region. It's been called various things, the pivot, the rebalancing. It has a military dimension to it. Importantly, though, it has an economic and a trade dimension, and it has a diplomatic dimension as well, with an emphasis on democracy and human rights.
But that focus, do you think that it's going to require the U.S. to understand that it may no longer be the largest economic engine in the world and no longer the most important military force in the world? Do we have to come to terms with that? Do you see it as an inevitability, and do we have to take that into account as we
Frank,
go forward?
That's a great question. We don't know right now where the United States is going to be, say, 25 years from now in terms of our relative economic and military power. What I do know is 25 years from now, likely militarily and likely economically, we're still going to be very dominant. Right now, in terms of military spending globally, the United States accounts globally for about 45% of military spending. To give you a compare and contrast, the Chinese military accounts for about 10 or 11% of global spending. So we're spending about four times as much. That's under debate. Some people say three times as much, but it's a lot more. We're a lot more capable military. Having said that, though, the Chinese are on such a rapid rise in terms of their power trajectory that it is imperative strategically that we do start to ask the questions that you're asking right now. With China's rise in terms, let's talk about its military capability, will it start to redefine its interest along its periphery in ways that are quite different from several decades ago? So as an example, is the United States in 1824 with President Monroe declaring the Monroe Doctrine a set of interest the U.S. expressed in the Western Hemisphere? Will the Chinese, as they accrue more power and more military capability, will they have their equivalent of a Monroe Doctrine, so to speak? That's possible. The best strategy for us, of course, is to continue to find ways to keep China engaged in the international community in a very liberal trade order, which hopefully begets political changes, and that we can find ways to, although compete with China and sometimes compete fiercely, as we have with the Japanese economically or the Germans, that we'll find ways to establish a framework where we will, although we will compete, we actually won't fight.
Are we seeing something like the Putin Doctrine in Ukraine? And what should be our response to what's happening there?
Well, the what's happening in the Ukraine right now, to talk a bit more about China, is it's interesting. The Chinese have said that Russia is a strategic partner of China. President Xi Jinping, the president of China, who's now been in office for a little over a year, his first trip abroad was to Moscow. So they treat that partnership seriously. And yet the Chinese, I think, are very nervous about the possibility of the Russians laying claim to Crimea, because they, the Chinese, have their own set of outstanding territorial issues. For instance, Taiwan. They would not like Taiwan to take a lead from Putin and find a way for them to break away. How we react to the situation in the Ukraine, I give the president very high marks, very thoughtful. The Crimea is not a area of the world that the American people want to go to war with the Russians over. And so a thoughtful approach where he's using economy, diplomacy, negotiations, but is showing military resolve and military capability through his work with NATO.
That thoughtful, broad-based approach is something that also speaks to, I think, an issue that's near and dear to you, which is the power of liberal arts education, critical thinking in applying ourselves, both as citizens and policymakers, to these complex questions.
Yeah, the it's a topic near and dear to my heart, and one, as you had said, Frank, that I'll be talking on at NC State University here at 3 o'clock this afternoon. But the role of the arts and humanities, the liberal arts education, in developing capable members of our armed forces, capable leaders, I think is absolutely essential. Military science, as it is today, has never been more complicated. You need young officers commanding formations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places in the world that know military science well, engineering, technology. Some of these young officers have more combat power available to them and information available to them than their grandfathers, who commanded divisions as general officers of 10,000 soldiers or Marines in the Second World War. And yet, that aside, a given, you've got to know the military science, but the humanities play such a vital role, because at the end of the day, warfare is a contest between nations and between people. It's about persuasion. It's about assurance. It's about deterrence. And these then have got to go into the human domain. So to give one example, if I have a captain who's fighting in Afghanistan in some remote valley, I assume that he knows his science. But also, is he struggling every day to make decisions about the interrelationship between the law of war as codified in the Geneva Convention, the impact of a serious incident involving civilian casualties in terms of the setback that it could have strategically, and then just the question of the moral thing to do? I want a captain who, so to speak, has read William Shakespeare's Henry V, which is a lot about the morality of warfare and leadership, and will find refuge in Henry V and be excited in reading it as he tries to come to grips with the dilemmas that he's faced with commanding a company in Helmand province in Afghanistan.
It strikes me that that is important knowledge for that captain, but also the civilian leadership who sent him or her there, and the civilian voters who sent that civilian leadership to Washington or Raleigh.
You're absolutely correct. We have a democracy, and we want our military to be fully accountable to that democracy. Those are the standards that our people value, and those are the ones that they expect from their forces abroad.
Carl, what a pleasure. So great to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank.
Carl Eikenberry is a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He joins NC State Chancellor Randy Woodson, Humanities Dean Jeff Braden, and Congressman David Price. Today, they're going to be at NC State this afternoon at the Hunt Library. We have more details on our website, stateofthings.org, if you want to find out about that 3 o'clock public forum today at NC State. Just ahead, the folk rock music of Houndmouth. Stay tuned.